I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Our guest this hour has written a number of very interesting things, analyzing who Republicans are now, who Democrats are. Matt Grossman is with us. He's director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and co-author of the book Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Political leaders, he says, typically pursue the goals of Democratic constituencies using tools and approaches that respond to conservative critiques of big government. He and his co-author have done a very interesting examination of the congressional debate over the Affordable Care Act, where Republicans, they say, successfully undermined overall popular support for the law by characterizing it as a government takeover of the American health care system, even though most of its specific provisions remained quite popular with the public. Done lots of other interesting writing, including Will the GOP Survive After Donald Trump? And an analysis of why Republicans chose Donald Trump and why Democrats chose Hillary Clinton. So all of that is up for discussion this hour. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hello, Matt. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Each 2016 presidential nominee you have written accurately represents how that party's voters view the great divide between Republicans and Democrats. So let's start with Republicans. Why did they choose Donald Trump?
Well, I don't want to say that we predicted that Trump would be the nominee or that he was only the only plausible nominee, but he does reflect a long tradition of vague general rhetoric about the direction of the country, about size and scope of government, and about the speed of social change. That's really unique to Republicans, that you have such little policy discussion and so much broad ideological rhetoric.
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton represents, well, the Democrats' traditional focus on assembling a coalition of groups, each with a specific set of policy priorities. And this year she faced a more than typical ideological challenge from Bernie Sanders, but that wasn't able to succeed against the large coalition of different ethnic, religious, and economic groups that Hillary Clinton was able to assemble.
Mm-hmm. And you could see, certainly during the Democratic convention, how she and her campaign appealed to each and every one of those groups, right?
They certainly did, and it's not just unique to the presidency. It's also true in congressional races that Democrats trot out endorsements from groups associated with each of their constituencies. They have a set of policies that are targeted at each one of their constituencies, and they really present different messages to each part of the electorate. And you just don't see that same approach among Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at, you've written a lot about this, and it's interesting to examine the congressional debate over the Affordable Care Act, where Republicans undermine and probably still continue to undermine overall popular support for it by characterizing this as a government takeover of the American healthcare system. But you also say the specific provisions remain quite popular with the public, and how the Democrats were able to get this through was playing down big government parts of this and actually instituting policy that wasn't big government policy.
Right. So this reflects a very long-running sort of contradiction in American public opinion, where people express liberal opinions when asked in specific terms, but they express conservative opinions when asked in general terms. So the classic example is everyone is for a smaller government, except in all of the areas where government is operating, they want more spending and more regulation. So that trend is taken advantage of by each political party. The Democrats have to stick in specific terms about who would benefit from each provision and how they developed each each individual policy to respond to a social problem, whereas Republicans are much better off characterizing it as an overall plan to expand the scope of government in our society, because that's where their advantage is. So you often see policy debates evolve this way, where something will maybe start as a popular policy idea, but Republicans are able to characterize it as part of a broader liberal ideological agenda.
Was there a time, I'm thinking of the New Deal, when big government, not everybody embraced it, but it certainly was something that was embraced by many in this country, and it was big government. Did we, for whatever reason, decide we weren't going to go that route, that we didn't like what happened during the New Deal, or how did we change from what we appear to have then to what we have now?
Well, there's always been some skepticism of large government that goes back to the founding. But the unique American attribute is really in sort of not agreeing with the premises behind liberal policies, even if we support those policies. So, for example, people are for raising taxes on the rich and solving healthcare problems through government policies all over the world. But it's only in the U.S. That we deny that we are in favor of redistribution or of government taking a broader role in the economy. So I think it goes back quite a long way, and it could be that in previous eras it just wasn't as big of a part of our political debate. But I think the conservative movement deserves credit from the 1950s to the 1980s really succeeded in increasing that skepticism of big government in the American public.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that the U.S. is the only country in the world that has a hard time specifically with health care, in guaranteeing health care for everyone? Is it going back to the founders, as you indicated, this fear of big government, or why everybody else and not us?
Well, there are several theories, not ours, that are about sort of the specific provisions that go back a long way, where we gave employers credits for providing health care to their employees. So some people would give a more specific historical explanation. But what we'd point to is just the broader pattern of American public policy. That is that we tend to use the tax code instead of direct spending. We tend to provide benefits through employers rather than through direct government. We tend to be decentralized with more state and local services rather than a large central government. And all of those really reflect responses to these conservative ideological critiques, where Democrats still want government to do new things, but they have compromised on how government would carry out those new things.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when you look at some of the policies that are wildly popular, like Medicare, you write that even Republican voters who identify as strong conservatives frequently depart from the orthodoxy on a specific question. If we've heard it once, we've heard it many, many times. Keep your hands off my Medicare.
Exactly. So it's not just a problem for Democrats. Republicans really only have the support of their voters and the electorate as a whole when things are kept in these broad terms. So when they actually get into power, like in 1994, and have to implement a program, and people see that actually smaller government means less spending on health care and education, they tend to react in a liberal direction.
Mm-hmm. Where do you look for information on this? Where do we stand as American public on issues like Social Security, Medicare, the expansion of Medicare, minimum wage? Is there a strong Democratic-Republican split on that?
Yes, there's a large split on most major policy issues, and it's growing over time. But I would say it's not as unique in the U.S. that we have those mostly liberal policy opinions. That tends to be, you know, fairly strong throughout. If you asked people whether more government, whether we should spend more money on pensions, you'd get a pretty positive answer in most places in the world. But I think what's unique to the U.S. is if you actually say, you know, should the government redistribute income from the rich to the poor, or should the government have a broader role in the economy, that's where you see very conservative and unique opinions in the U.S.
Mm. If you ask the question, redistribute income, what if you ask the question, should the upper 1% be taxed more heavily?
Absolutely. Then you get a liberal answer. So basically, people support the policies, but not the principles behind those policies.
You talk about federalism, Republicans favoring federalism over nationalization. Give us a definition of federalism and how important that's been to the whole vision of America and the fight over America.
Yeah, well, for a very long time, there's been a set of principles associated with not increasing the power of the national government and trying to do as much possible through state and local governments as possible. And what we've seen in the U.S. is since the rise of the conservative movement, there really hasn't been an expansion of the federal employment state, a bunch of new big agencies doing new things. Instead, what you've seen is government grow in scope, but you've seen it carried out more through state and local governments, more through private contractors, more through grants through nonprofits. So what we've done is kept adding new things to government's plate, but really not increased the capacity of the central government to actually carry them out directly.
Mm-hmm. We look at certain industries, like certain areas like prisons in this country, and we really have supported a lot of private firms, right, to take over that whole area of justice.
Absolutely, and most by states as well. So even though there's been this massive increase in incarceration in the U.S., it hasn't necessarily led to a nationalization of criminal justice.
Mm-hmm. Matt, when you say on the whole Americans call themselves conservative but prefer liberal policies, when they're calling themselves conservative, what are they saying?
Well, there's a sort of a dispute because some people are saying different things. There are, of course, some Americans who call themselves conservatives and hold mostly conservative policy positions. But that turns out not really to be a majority of the people who call themselves conservatives. And so there's been an ongoing search for, well, maybe some people just prioritize social issue attitudes and some prioritize economic policy attitudes. And it's true that both people who are libertarians and people who are the opposite of libertarians have moved toward Republican and conservative identification. So you might say it's a coalition of of people who agree with some party policy positions but not others. But what we would say is that what ties it together is really these general principles that are much more popular than the policy positions of the Republican Party.
What is Donald Trump?
I think he is certainly he's conservative in the sense that he's standing athwart history, yelling stop. He's talking about the American social change going too fast, about nationalism. But where he is very distinct in comparison to past Republican candidates is in really not giving us any of the small government rhetoric that usually is quite central to Republican campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And is one of the main sources of disagreement, if not estrangement, from Republican establishment politicians?
Yeah, that's true. That one reason that he's creating such a stir within the party is because he's sort of failed to follow along with the traditional Republican playbook. I think what's interesting this year, though, is that we just haven't seen much follow-through in state races or in congressional races of Trumpian-like candidates. So it's possible that they are out there. But most Republicans this year are running on a pretty traditional conservative message, and Trump is the outlier.
Mm-hmm. And Hillary Clinton, is she a liberal?
I think in policy positions, she certainly should be classified as a liberal. But I think in the way she talks about political pragmatism and the way that she's acted, she tends to always be willing to compromise with Republicans on the form of new government policy, to try to find agreement between the parties. And I think we've been seeing, because the WikiLeaks leaks and the speeches in character, characterizing herself regularly as somewhat in between the two ideological extremes.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, because I know you've written about this, and I'm wondering, we'll ask it about the Democrats as well. I know you've written about the GOP and whether or not it will survive after Donald Trump. I have a question about that, why you think it will. And then let me ask after that. Well, let me hold off on question number two. Why do you think the GOP will survive after Donald Trump?
Well, we should just be clear about the state of affairs. You know, the Republican Party controls at least one branch of the state legislature and or the governorship in 43 states. They have the highest congressional majorities that they've had since the 1920s. So this is, other than the presidential race not going well at the moment for them, we don't see a lot of signs that a party is going down. Instead, we see signs of strength, and we'll see how long that holds, but not a lot of sense that we're going to have a major transformation anytime soon. So I understand why people think, well, Trump is very different. He is presenting a different message, but we just don't have the wider party seeming to take the direction that he's taken it.
Hmm. And yet, who knows what's going to happen in the next 3.5 weeks of this campaign. I was watching some of his campaign address today, and you know, a good chunk of it was attacking the New York Times and the women who have accused him of very, very improper behavior. I wonder how much of that, then I wonder what all of that does to the party, actually. If he has to stay on that kind of message for the next 3.5 weeks, what in the world is it going to do to the party?
Well, it's certainly true that nominating someone without experience in politics and with a volatile personality is going to have consequences, especially for this election. But I don't know how long it will last, and I think that a Hillary Clinton administration will do a lot to bring the Republican Party back together in opposition to her new initiatives, just like they were brought together in 1993 and 2009 to oppose the agendas of new Democratic presidents. So that tends to heal divisions pretty fast if you're just in opposition.
Do you assume then that Hillary Clinton will embrace, as she has with a strong challenge from Bernie Sanders, that she will embrace some of his platforms should she become president?
Well, she's adopted some of his positions and come to compromises on some others. I think the open question is on prioritization. That is, what exactly is she going to pursue, especially if she doesn't have a fully Democratic Congress to work with in this spring? Is she going to pursue sort of her initial focus more on things like family and medical leave and child care, or is she going to try to do everything at once that she's promised, like immigration reform, like climate change, like college affordability? I think it's unlikely that all of that's going to pass. So I think the open question is, where is her focus going to be?
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, Matt. We'll take them in a moment. Matt Grossman is our guest, director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University, and a co-author of Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about Republicans and Democrats. We, of course, can't ignore what's going on in the presidential campaign and how candidates may or may not embrace what the party embraces. What does it mean to you if you call yourself a conservative, and who responds politically to your beliefs? If you call yourself a liberal, or if you call yourself a progressive, or you call yourself a moderate Democrat, what does that mean to you? And how do you see parties trying to use the dislike of certain policies by the other party, the Democrats, as our guest has written about, trying to fashion Affordable Care Act so it wouldn't be seen as a big government takeover, and that resulted in the way the whole thing is formulated. 800-486-8655 will be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's start with a comment here on an email, Matt. The priorities of both parties are apparent in the legislation they put forward. Voter ID, for example, is a purely Republican idea. Universal health care, a Democratic one. The rise of Donald Trump is directly attributable to the policies of the Republican Party.
Well, I think there's just first a broad difference in the degree of policy focus within each party. So Democratic presidents propose more policies. Democratic legislators tend to pass more significant policies. And Democratic control tends to be associated with more legislation passing. So when you have one party that is less focused or focused on retracting the role of government in society, it tends to be a little less focused on a policy overall. But certainly, there are big differences in policy focus between the two parties, and they're reflected in the legislation that they do put forward.
And let's go to phone calls. Andy in Viroqua is our first caller. Hi, Andy.
Hi there. I'm an independent, nonpartisan, and I just got to say, this electoral season's been everything from hilarious to heartbreaking for people like me. It seems like, I guess the whole of the nation is like runs their, respective echo chambers and refuses to leave until mom comes down with some candy or something. I'm a policy person, and I gotta say these debates are, there's so little substance in either, from either side. And it seems like the establishment candidate has been picked and preened a long time ago. And it's almost like Donald's there just to play the fool and, you know, shame you into voting for Hillary. So people like me, we're nonpartisans, and we constantly hear from either side that it's, you know, you have to pick the lesser of two evils. And that's the antithesis of democracy. How can this be? You know, why are we not letting other candidates that don't identify with the two major parties debate? They're not debates. They're just conversations. I'm really good at just speaking at people and letting the fire hose go, and that's all we get from the media. And
wait, so
I
Andy,
don't think I should be president.
Are you going third party?
I don't know. I think I'm going to vote for Joaquin Guzman, El Chapo. I'm doing a write-in because at least he's honest about what a murderous thug he is.
All right. A lot of people share the dismay at this particular election. Would you like to comment on it, Matt?
Well, certainly this is normal than usual distrust of the major party candidates. They're both very unpopular. I disagree that it's equivalent on both sides. I think just if you just look at the policy proposals on the candidates' websites or the amount of time that each candidate spends discussing policy on the stump, you're just going to find huge differences, with Hillary Clinton much more interested in policy details than Donald Trump. But I think it is true that we're increasingly in some information cocoons, where we're listening and interpreting our own messages from our own partisan sides. But again, I don't think it's equivalent. The conservative movement explicitly built a conservative media infrastructure and built distrust in the mainstream media among its supporters. And that was based on a reality that reporters, just like professors, were much more likely to be liberals and Democrats than the rest of the population. But as a result, conservatives built alternative infrastructures for media and research and are more likely to be only listening to explicitly conservative alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, before we go back to phone calls, about the role of the press in all of this. Donald Trump is taking on in a big way the New York Times, saying he's going to sue them today for their front page story. His rise, you have written, to political prominence, aided by the unique media universe of the American right. I would argue that the American left participated as well, though. Prior to his candidacy, he made regular appearances on Fox News as an outspoken critic of President Barack Obama. His campaign insulated from early attacks by support from conservative talk show hosts, and that's kind of splintered now, too. There's a divide among those hosts whose influence over voters is unmatched on the left. A couple questions. With the prominence of talk cable, you know, you hope you'd be getting a whole lot of really serious discussions, but you don't. You get all these talking heads, both on the right and on the left. How important are they in shaping the whole agenda of a party and in shaping voters' views as to whether or not they can. You almost say, well, I agree with people on Fox News, or I agree with people on MSNBC.
There's still the vast majority of voters are still paying attention to just their local TV news and only a little bit of news in between the sports and weather. So it's not that everybody is watching these explicitly ideological broadcasts, but it's much more common on the right than the left. Fox's news ratings are three times the size of MSNBC. Lots of attempts to build liberal radio networks like Air America have been unsuccessful, and the reason is because liberals don't distrust the mainstream media as much as conservatives do. So that's why you're constantly seeing Republican candidates, certainly not unique to Trump, running against the mainstream media, claiming liberal bias, and claiming that you should instead pay attention to the explicitly conservative alternatives. So that's been a good strategy, and as a result, it's increased distrust in the mainstream media over time, especially among conservatives.
Brenda in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for having your show.
Sure, Brenda.
I have a question. I'm totally fed up with both candidates. And, you know, we're working on a different time in our lives. Our kids are growing up, our grandkids are out of future that we don't know what's going to happen. But we don't hear about the third parties. I know it's campaigning and advertising is expensive, but I believe there was one president that was not a Republican and not a Democrat. I can't remember if it was Coolidge, and when you get older, names don't come back to you like you were. And what is the possibility of a third party winning this other than Bernie Sanders? I hear a lot about Gary Johnson. I've done some research on him. But we don't hear about that, and the public radio stations or the news media won't interview them or don't interview them. And I just want his thought on the possibility, or how, and with you, how we can get more information on the third parties that are out there.
Well, the constraints on third parties are really institutional, are not as much about beliefs in the American public. So certainly there's, you know, an electorate that, you know, could agree with Gary Johnson. There's an electorate that could agree with Jill Stein, and that isn't the problem. But I don't think that you can therefore say that, you know, it's the media's fault or someone else's. It's everyone responding to our electoral institutions, where we're only going to elect one president, so it tends to move towards a one-on-one contest, and our congressional electoral system, which is based on geographic districts, which only have one winner each. Those electoral systems are actually somewhat unique in the world. It's not that we're the only country with them, but they tend to move countries toward more of a two-party system, and that's the main reason why third parties aren't as competitive in the U.S.
I want to ask you a little bit more about third parties, because it seems as though there are a couple interesting things taking place. Well, there are a lot of interesting things, more than a couple, but when we looked at the primary, I do think that Bernie Sanders' incredible and unexpected success in that primary, particularly among millennial voters, is something to be reckoned with beyond this presidential election, that's going to fundamentally do something to alter politics in this country. The other thing that seems to be happening is that we are increasingly becoming a majority-minority population, which I think also may dramatically change our political parties. What do you think?
Well, in some ways, those two trends kind of work against each other to change the Democratic Party. The young people's, and especially educated white liberals' support for Bernie Sanders suggests that there may be an opening for a more forthright, ideological, more liberal set of candidates within the Democratic Party. But if you watch Bernie over the course of the election, he started adopting more of the Hillary Clinton messages as we got beyond Iowa and New Hampshire, these white liberal states, in order to attract more of the diversity of the Democratic electorate. And so he had to go through the same laundry list of policy proposals that Hillary Clinton had already been focused on. So there are some important trends. Young people are a little bit more likely to be willing to call themselves liberal, so we'll watch and see if that continues. But we also have to see more than just a presidential candidate. So Bernie, it's only been a few months, and Bernie Sanders' organization does not seem to have been very successful in influencing congressional or state elections or recruiting Bernie-like candidates for future elections. So it's just not a lot of evidence that it's going to last beyond this election so far.
Let's go to Brenda. Thanks very much for your call. Matt in Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard this several times. I heard it from you, and I heard it from, I think, somebody on Morning Joe this morning, saying that the Republican Party had never had more seats in the House than they ever have. But I still find that to be surprising that they don't think they should change, given the fact that gerrymandering has been the root cause of all of these seats of power. Do you think that this is going to change? As you know, the comment was just made that we're going to become a minority majority very soon, with Republicans not really embracing LGBT and disparity of wealth. Do we see that changing?
Republicans have not traditionally responded to election losses by moving to the center, and I don't think it's very likely after this election either. They tend to interpret election losses as we weren't sufficiently conservative, we didn't lay out our full vision, rather than moving to the center. Obviously, if the country, you know, becomes more liberal over time, that could start to change, but the direction of public opinion is usually the opposite of policy change. So in the 1980s, we actually saw more liberal public opinion, but when when Democrats are in charge, we tend to see conservative moves in public opinion. So just like 2008, they, you know, had a big loss, and they thought maybe they needed to transform themselves, but then in the very next midterm election, they were able to take over Congress. Due to both differences in turnout in midterm elections and to real moves in public opinion in a conservative direction. So if that happens again this time, then they won't necessarily need to change.
Thanks, Matt, so much for your call. And let us go to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to touch on, I was at a lunch event today where Senator Paul Ryan was speaking, and it was just interesting that he didn't really talk about Donald Trump at all, other than to make reference about, you know, who knows what's going on Twitter today, or, you know, what jokes are being made. And it really seemed like he was trying to rally the GOP in spite of Donald, not in support of him. Mm. And I'm just curious if that's what we're facing, is a silent majority that is going to come to the voting boxes that are on election day and get behind the GOP in spite of Donald, and what that's going to do for the conservative Republican.
And Tom, what were the rallying points that Ryan used today at the lunch?
Well, he was heavily focused on the health care reform. You know, he directed everybody to the website, abetterway.speaker.gov, where it really spells out, a platform that Donald hasn't talked too in-depth about, but things that are consistent with what I'm looking for and what I want to hear about. So it's interesting that it really seemed like he's saying, hey, get behind the GOP. Don't focus. Don't let Donald distract you from what's most important here and this platform that we have.
Interesting, Matt.
Yeah, so traditionally the worry about the presidential candidate not doing well is more about turnout. If people usually turn out in presidential elections to vote for the president, and so if they're not motivated to participate, they may not turn out. But what's different about Donald Trump is he tends to actually be doing worse among sort of regular Republican voters than others. So there may still be people who turn out even if they're unwilling to or reluctantly supporting Donald Trump. And so far, we haven't seen a lot of evidence that it is trickling down to that Donald Trump's poor performance in the last month is trickling down to the other races. So the Republicans are still competitive for the U.S. Senate right now. They are not showing a lot of signs that the House is under threat, and similarly in other state elections. So it could be that it is just Donald Trump and that the rest of the Republican Party does okay this election, but their worry should be turnout, whether people are going to be motivated to participate.
And what do you think about that? When you look at moderate Republicans, and I've spoken to many of them, they have real concerns about Donald Trump. Are they Republicans, vote? They really do vote. They show up more than Democrats do frequently. Will they vote even though they may not want to cast a ballot for the top of the ticket?
I mean, voting is habitual, so most people who voted regularly will find it hard to stay away this time. But, you know, slight differences in who's likely to turn out can make a big difference in election results. And I don't think we're going to see the turnout that we have seen in the last two cycles, which was a little bit higher than normal, and, for example, saw high levels of participation by young people. I don't think there's much sign of that just based on people saying that they're certain to vote. You're not seeing the same a likelihood of a high turnout of the last two elections.
Tom, thanks for the call. Our number, 800-486-8655. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about a number of issues. We're looking really at the philosophy of the Republican Party, the Democratic Party now, and looking at how Democrats have had to fashion some of their legislation, i.e. the Affordable Care Act, because of Republicans giving a message of we don't want a big government takeover, and a lot of people embrace that. So the Democrats fashioning legislation that keeps that from being an issue, thus the whole structure of the Affordable Care Act. But we're looking at a number of issues as well because of all that's going on in the presidential race. Our guest is Matt Grossman. He is director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and co-author of Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. Back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, Joshua in Milwaukee. Next caller, Matt. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I'd like to say, first off, the last caller mistakenly referred to Paul Ryan as a senator. He's not a senator, but that sort of disinformation and misinformation on the GOP side doesn't surprise me. But I would like to say that I don't understand why so many people, and especially older people in this election cycle, have this idea that since they don't know what's going to happen in 30 or 40 years when their grandkids grow up, they're afraid. And I just want to know what 10-year-old in 1959 predicted the Internet. I see that as just such a crazy argument to say that because we don't know what's going to happen in 40 years that we have to be so afraid of the future, that we have to trust people who want to take us to the past.
Matt.
I don't have a specific comment on the economic future, but I guess I would just point out that Donald Trump is really American politics borrowing from trends that have been evident elsewhere in the world. Most countries have an anti-immigration nativist party, and the Republican Party has actually traditionally been a little bit less conservative on that than most right-wing parties in the world. And so what you're seeing is something that's a worldwide response to demographic and economic change, and it shouldn't be surprising that it's also happening in the United States.
Let's move into the realm of foreign policy, which Susan M. Racine will do when I read her email, which is, what do you think, Matt, about the two candidates and their parties, how they would handle the saber-rattling by Russia?
Well, what's been really interesting in this election is Donald Trump's complete movement away from traditional Republican Party policy positions on foreign policy. And I think it illustrates an important point about the nature of those positions in the Republican electorate, which is that they really were just general nationalism, this idea that the U.S. is the best country in the world, and so they could handle both George W. Bush's foreign policy, which was quite interventionist, and Donald Trump's foreign policy, which has not been as fully outlined, but is clearly a whole lot more isolationist and less interventionist. So it's interesting that both sets of those policy positions could find their home within the same Republican voters, and I think it's because that basis of Republican Party support isn't really about policy. It's about a general American nationalism and a desire for American strength in the world.
Thank you, Joshua. Let's go to Mike in Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good afternoon. Hey, the thing I'm confused about, why do they keep saying Donald Trump is a change candidate? He already said who he's going to appoint to the Supreme Court. They're going to make Citizens United worse, not going to be better. More money is going to control this country. And his number one economic plan is a gigantic tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. That's the same old stuff. That don't sound like a change to me. I'm a white working man. Guess what? That's the same old stuff I heard from Republicans for the last 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I think that it's not that surprising that the party out of the power in the presidency is seeing itself more as the party of change. That's basically true in every presidential election. Whoever's the current president, the party of the current president is sort of stuck being the party of the status quo a little bit more than the party that is out of power. So that doesn't mean that the Republicans have necessarily changed their economic policy positions. I think the only sign of that from Donald Trump is really on trade, but it certainly means that they're more likely to succeed with a change message than someone like Hillary Clinton, who, after all, was a part of this administration and so can't easily divorce herself from it.
You've written in one of the many things that you've written, the test of Trump's impact will come in 2017. How so?
Well, I think we always think, you know, during the election, whatever's happening right now is going to be the wave of the future. But that isn't necessarily the case. If Donald Trump loses and Hillary Clinton becomes president, we'll get to see whether the Republicans in Congress act very differently or whether they pursue the same strategy that they did in 2009 when Barack Obama was first elected. And that strategy was basically to be the party of opposition. And it's a strategy that worked to win the midterm election. So Donald Trump will still be around, but the extent to which he'll be influencing the rest of the party will depend on whether we see Trump-like candidates for Congress and state, and whether it's a message that can really be translated into policymaking in a different way than previous Republican messages. And I think it's much more likely to just be translated into opposition to Hillary Clinton.
Is there such a thing as a Trump-like candidate? No, really, is there?
Well, people point to Paula Page and some a few examples, but there really aren't. But even if he wasn't like Trump as a personality, I think we're just not seeing any evidence that lots of Republican candidates in Congress or the states are taking new positions on trade. The immigration position is really an extension of a position that most new Republican officials have been adopting. So there's just not a lot of sense that change is coming beyond Trump winning the presidency, if he were to do that.
Thank you, Mike, for the call. We got a Kirk in Manchester. Hi, Kirk. You there, Kirk? Kirk is not there anymore. Christine in Franklin. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Christine. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm from Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I was just saying that I usually always vote Republican, And I was listening to one of your shows this morning, and somebody, I thought, hit the nail right on the head. They said that the reason Donald Trump is where he is at is because of his notoriety. And I thought, somebody is exactly right. I think that when I first heard he was running, I thought, oh, he'll be a great choice because he'll try and get this country, our financial situation, in order. Mm-hmm. But then after I heard him talk, I thought there is no way I would vote for him. But I don't, truthfully, I wouldn't vote for either of them.
So what will you do, Christine?
I'm going to vote Democrat.
You are?
I would 100% vote Democrat because I think he could cause World War III. I don't know. The guy is just shouldn't be president of the United States.
Thanks for your thoughts, Christine. Matt, you want to comment?
Yeah, I mean, that caller represents the reason that Donald Trump has moved further behind, that he isn't able to consolidate your traditional Republican vote, which, you know, should be close to 50-50 in a normal year. So the Republicans really took an election where they should have been competitive and nominated someone who's a lot less popular of a candidate. I do think there are some one-off factors, like the caller mentioned. You know, Oprah Winfrey asked if Donald Trump would run for president in 1988. So he's been, you know, out there as a popular and well-known figure for a very long time, and it's unclear how many other people could have pursued the same kind of strategy that he did to the nomination.
Well, he's going to have a heck of a time right now. I don't know if you saw the Marquette poll that was released yesterday, and it was interesting because it was taken Thursday through Sunday, so they could break down and see what happened to voters, particularly female voters, after the release of the tape on Friday. And oh my gosh, he just lost a huge number of women voters with all of these allegations that are coming forward with his, you know, deciding to take it case by case, and these are false, this is false, I'm going to sue the New York Times, this is false. It's hard to imagine that there aren't going to be more such stories coming out, that he is going to have one difficult time, particularly with female voters, don't you think?
It does look like we're going to see a larger gender gap than we've ever seen. But it's important to realize that these are mostly accelerations of trends that were already underway. So Democrats were already doing better among minority voters over time. They were already doing better among women voters over time. They were already doing better among highly educated white voters over time. And Republicans had been gaining among working class white voters or less education white voters. So Donald Trump is accelerating those trends, but in some ways, they were really already underway.
So let's imagine for a moment a Hillary Clinton presidency, which at least today looks more likely than a Trump presidency. Who knows what will happen in the next few weeks? Are there strengths that she has in being able to, you know, have a drink after Congress is closed with its session, come on over to the White House and let's hash out some of these issues? We're buddies. We've known each other for a long time. Are we in an era where the ideology is so defined that that's just never going to happen?
Well, most constraints on policymaking in the president are structural. They're about the overall polarization, about the party positions and the divided government that we are likely to see in some form. So all of those things will be sort of working against her in the same way that they were working against Obama. But I wouldn't completely discount the role of her congressional experience and her prior relationships with Republicans. We have seen some presidents with more experience be more successful in making bipartisan deals. I think Obama did come into office with a broad agenda, and although he tried to get Republican support for that agenda, he did not necessarily go out and look for small victories that he could get with Republican support based more on their agenda. So I think it's possible that Hillary Clinton will do a little bit more in that direction, and so may have more success.
And putting his personality aside, if Donald Trump were president, would he, on the basis of his not taking on Social Security and Medicare, would he have an easier time finding bipartisan support for whatever his policies might be?
I think whoever becomes president this time is going to have a very low approval rating at the very start of their presidency. They're not going to have much of a honeymoon, and there's very little sign that they would be given the benefit of the doubt by Congress or the voters.
We have about 30 seconds. Tom from Burlington, go ahead.
The Republicans have 33 districts of the states in the United States that they control in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And I don't count them out. They're not out at all. And my cousin was going to build the tallest building in the world down in Chicago based on Calatrava, the architect we hear in Milwaukee. And Mr. Trump did everything he could to keep that building from being put up.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for the call. Matt Grossman, our guest this hour. Thank you, Matt, for covering all kinds of topics with us this hour, which I anticipated we would. Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt Grossman, Director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University. He is co-author of Asymmetric Politics, Ideological Republicans and Group Interest Democrats. And we thank him for his time and for all of your contributions. Lots of emails and telephone calls. And if you want to leave a message on what we've talked about on Facebook, we'd love to read it or become our friend, you know, like us, and then you'll know what we're talking about every day. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up.